Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. Jim Lehrer died a few weeks ago. He was 85. He, of course, hosted PBS's NewsHour. He was an anchor in public broadcasting for well over 35 years. He moderated a dozen presidential debates. With his Texas accent, he was affable and charming, but he was also incisive and unwavering when he needed to be. He was a giant in the world of journalism, and particularly in the world of public broadcasting. When I talked to him in 2010, he'd just written a sort of mystery novel. Yes, he also wrote over 20 novels. The book I talked to him about was called Super. It was set in the early 1950s aboard the Super Chief, the legendary train that ran through the American Midwest and Southwest. Anyway, let's go to my apartment, where I recorded an interview with the late, great Jim Lehrer. I know that you went to a junior college, got an associate's degree before you went to four-year school.
Right.
My mom's a junior college professor. I find that often often people who go to JC, it's because they're taking some unusual path. It's rare for someone to go to JC because they're, you know, just doing 2 years here and then 2 years there, and that was the plan all along. What led you, what was your path?
The reason I went to JC, my junior college, was because we couldn't afford to go to the University of Texas. And, I had to go to work. And, the junior college in Victoria, for $40, I could go to school the whole year. $40. And I took this job working in a bus depot, worked 8 hours a day at night. And but I also was editor of the newspaper, wrote and edited every story that was in the newspaper, wrote the editorials in addition to the news stories, and then took it to the local newspaper and they printed it, and then I came back to the campus and handed it out to all 320 of my fellow and sister students. So anyhow, it was a marvelous experience, but it never occurred to me that I would not eventually go on to college and finish and get a degree and get a journalism degree and be a writer and be Ernest Hemingway or Ernie Pyle or one of those people. And the H.L. Mencken, for instance, had this library about the size of two bedrooms at this little junior college, and there was a librarian there and said, you want to be a newspaper man, is that right? And I said, yes, ma'am. She said, well, there's a guy named H.L. You ever heard of H.L. Mencken? I said, no. Well, look, there's a book down here. You ought to read this. It's a biography of him, and it was written by a guy named William Manchester. William Manchester went on to write many books, including Death of a President. He was the guy who wrote the book about the Kennedy assassination. And anyhow, I read the book, and this is what I wanted to be. And then I wanted to be H.L. Mencken. But all these things just happened, and I've just been so fortunate each step along the way. When it came time that, okay, now I was going to go to a university and finish and get a journalism degree, I wrote, because I had a typewriter available, I had a typewriter in the office of the bus depot where I was working. I wrote to 37 colleges and universities and asked for their catalogs. Only state colleges, I mean, state universities. There was no private schools like Harvard or any of that on my horizons. And I decided on the University of Missouri because it had a great journalism reputation and all that. And I wrote a letter and applied at the University of Missouri.
Working in a bus depot while you were still in school, working nights, must have been a great place both to produce an entire newspaper, but also to, a place where your thoughts are on, literal places you can go.
Absolutely. It was the best breeding ground I have ever had for it to be a writer. I mean, I was behind a ticket counter one night and I heard a woman scream, and it was a very small waiting room, and I went into the waiting room, and it was a woman's restroom. The woman had slit her wrists. One day, a guy was at the ticket counter, and as he said he wanted a one-way ticket to Houston. I made out the ticket, and just as I put the ticket on the counter, two cops came in and arrested him. This man had just robbed somebody and all this sort of stuff. One time they had the Border Patrol was coming in and rounding up, because this is South Texas, so a lot of brown-skinned people around, and they were being rounded up as illegal immigrants. I had a guy I worked right next to as another ticket agent who was filling in for me and whatever, and he stole money from me. I didn't know that by the way he sold tickets that were, he sold them, but it looked like I was the agent, and so he pocketed the money, and then the auditors thought I had stolen the money. And it was, I learned a lot about the, I also learned how to speak into a microphone. You want me to demonstrate that?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Please.
All right. It was the first time I was paid money to speak into a microphone. This is Victoria, Texas, halfway between Houston and Corpus Christi. May I have your attention, please? This is your last call for Continental Trailways, 8:10 p.m. Silversides Air Conditioned Through Liner to Houston. Now leaving from Lane 1 for Inez, Edna, Ganado, Louise, El Campo, Pierce, Wharton, Hungerford, Kendleton, Beasley, Rosenberg, Richmond, Sugarland, Stafford, Missouri City, and Houston. All aboard! Don't forget your baggage, please.
10 stars. That's what I award that
Thank
performance.
You. Thank you.
Your first broadcast journalism job was at KERA in Dallas,
That's
if
right.
I'm not mistaken.
That's right, public television station.
How did you end up in public TV rather than commercial TV?
I was a newspaper reporter, newspaper editor. I was city editor of the afternoon newspaper in Dallas, Dallas Times Herald. I'd written a novel. It was made into a movie. We made $45,000 on the movie, which was a lot of money. This is 1959. This was 1969. Sorry, 1969. The book came out in 1966. The movie came out in 69. And my wife, Kate, we had two kids and the third one coming. And Kate said, well, you know, you always said you wanted to write full-time. Let's do it. And she was a writer, too. And so I quit to write full-time. And the public television station in Dallas, I'd only been on television one time, and that was kind of a local meet-the-press type thing. And they called me and asked me if I would be a consultant to them for news and public affairs, work 2 days a week. They didn't do any programs, so I figured, you know, what the hell have I got to lose? And it was great. And then one thing led to another, and we decided to try an experimental news program, got a Ford Foundation grant. I wrote a proposal, and Fred Friendly, the famed Fred Friendly, who was in with the Ford Foundation, funded us. And suddenly I was on television, and I hired nothing but former newspaper reporters, and did that for two years, and then I was offered an opportunity to go to PBS, to go to Washington. And I never worked in commercial television. The University of Missouri School of Journalism, to be on television, I mean, give me a break. I mean, that's not serious. People don't go on television. Serious people write for newspapers and magazines. So I didn't take any courses. I had no longing to do it at all, no desire to do it. But I had the opportunity, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I mean, it was, I never turned back, and I have, as I say, I've never worked in any other kind of television but public television, and I've been blessed to be with people who shared all my values and all my aspirations. It's been terrific.
It must have been exciting to get involved in public television at a time when public television was really figuring out what it was and what it could be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was kind of created as a result of a meeting. You know, there were some people who thought, well, no, we've got this thing here. It's called educational television. Now, educational television was, you know, television from the classroom, and there was television stations all over the country, education, because it had been mandated by Congress, And then somebody said, "Well, let's do more than just that's more than classroom stuff. Well, let's do things for children." And Sesame Street got developed, and they started doing documentaries. And I came with KERA and then the PBS. PBS had just been formed, the Public Broadcasting Service, which is everybody calls it a network. It's not a network at all. It's essentially a programming service. It's a cooperative. It's run by all the more than 300 public television stations, and it keeps reinventing itself all the time. The purposes kind of remain the same, but there's always been funding problems in public broadcasting, and they're always.
you don't have to tell me, we're sitting in my second bedroom.
Have you heard that? Yeah. And so the interesting thing about it, about not having a lot of money to broadcast in a business that requires a lot of money to broadcast, is that you get your priorities straight, whether you want to. You can't afford to waste any money on something that doesn't matter. And so if you say, well, we could do this little cute story about pineapple sundaes or something like that, or we could probably do something on the fall of the Berlin Wall, maybe send somebody there for an extra day. Well, we do the Berlin stuff because you can't do both. So that really focuses your mind. And it exists to this very day. I mean, public broadcasting right now, the NewsHour, we've been on the air for 35 years. We have financial problems. But we are more vital, more viable, and more innovative now than we were before, because we have to use our money so wisely. We use every little technological thing. You know, you used to spend thousands, millions of dollars on satellite fees. Well, you can do that now through the internet, but it's very difficult to do, and it takes time. You got to have people, most of them young, who know how to use the technology to our advantage, and it keeps a little bit of hunger. Is good for people who are trying to do serious business in journalism.
We'll finish up my interview with Jim Lehrer after a break. Stick around. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
It's Oscar season, and we don't want you to show up on the red carpet unprepared. That's why NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help you sort through the nominees and separate the best from the rest. Listen now, and we might even help you dominate your Oscars pool.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my friend's favor.
Judge John Hodgman ruled in my favor.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. You're hearing the voices of real litigants, real people who have submitted disputes to my internet court at the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I hear their cases, I ask them questions, they're good ones, and then I tell them who's right and who's wrong.
Thanks to Judge John Hodgman's ruling, my dad has been forced to retire one of the worst dad jokes of all time.
Instead of cutting his own hair with a Flowbee, my husband has his hair cut professionally.
I have to join a community theater group.
And my wife has stopped bringing home wild animals.
It's the Judge John Hodgman podcast. Find it every Wednesday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
Thanks, Judge John Hodgman.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. We're replaying my 2010 interview with the late Jim Lehrer. He was the host of PBS's NewsHour and the moderator at 12 presidential debates. He died last month. He was 85. You know, TV news is, by its sort of very nature, a linear form. There's no way to, there is to some extent now in new media, but essentially what you're doing is, unlike a newspaper where you're essentially providing a smorgasbord of different stuff, everything from crossword puzzles to the jumble to international news to, a real estate column. Television news is presenting something to you where the assumption is that you're going through from beginning to end and, paying attention to all of it, even if maybe you care a little bit more about one part or another. How do you think that linearity, that need to sort of like make a judgment of this is the stuff that everyone who's watching should get affects your news judgment relative to, for example, doing print?
Sure. Well, that's basically the old-fashioned view. I mean, it's the gatekeeper form of journalism. I've been a gatekeeper for over 30 years. And before, when I was an editor of a newspaper, I was a gatekeeper. Essentially, you just outlined it. The stuff comes in, and you're known by the stories you don't do, as well as the stories you do do. And it is absolutely right. It's linear. Now, the new world order in information is completely horizontal. It's coming at you all the time, and it's in your right and your left, and it's over you, under you, it's everywhere. The flood of information, you cannot go anywhere without somebody either yelling at you or telling you something that you analytically or otherwise, it may be true or may not be true or whatever. In the old days, in the linear days, we, the old-fashioned gatekeeper, would sort through all of that, and then we'd have a neat and tidy newspaper or a neat and tidy newscast. Now, the horizontal, what we're doing with the NewsHour, as I've said a million times to people, I don't care if you watch it linearly as a television program or you watch it horizontally on a pink iPod. It's the journalism that matters. And what we're also doing, and everybody's doing it, we're not the only ones, is if you've got a journalism perspective that is real and that is verifiable and professional, we'll make a deal with you. Collaboration to amortize journalism costs, that's what we have to do. The idea that the newspapers can afford to send two or three reporters to City Hall anymore, forget it. You know, they may send one reporter, and that person may also have to do television, may also do blogs, may also do radio things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what we all have to do. All of us who care about journalism and are in the business, we have to familiarize ourselves with all of the horizontal stuff and let the mechanics worry about how we get all that out there. And eventually, what's happening now is it's become almost... There's going to be a reinvention of the linear approach because there's so much stuff. Most people do not want to spend all day in front of a computer screen reading blogs or listening to radio, not your program, but other programs, people screaming at each
Most
other.
Most people do want to spend their whole day listening to my program.
Yes, that's right. But that's the only exception that I can think of. Everybody but that. We would have folks, the new gatekeepers, they won't be old white men. Like I am, there's going to be a whole new generation of gatekeepers, and they're going to have to build trust, just like newspaper A and newspaper B and television newspaper whatever, and they will say, okay, I want to know what Jesse had to say today, but I didn't have time to listen to it. I don't want to hear the whole thing maybe, but I want to be able to do it, but I also want to know what did the New York Times say about this today. And also, by the way, there's this weird blogger out here. And somebody who does this professionally goes through all of this for people. And those gatekeepers, those people who do that, they have to build up trust and all that sort of stuff. That's where we're going. That's where we're headed. There's too much stuff out there, and it's driving people crazy, in a good way. You know, all this information is available, but they need some help.
We talked about the ways that resources shape priorities. In public radio news, there was always this joke, and maybe it's a little less applicable today, but it was that since there were very few reporters, since NPR maybe had a couple dozen reporters, they would mostly read about something in the newspaper, report it the next day, and call it analysis.
Mm-hmm.
In a funny way, while NPR now, say, has a few hundred reporters rather than a few dozen reporters and hundreds more if you count local stations, that perspective has been a strength of the form as those resources have grown rather than a weakness. That idea that timeliness isn't the only essential quality of news. And I wonder what ways you can distinguish your news content that aren't just first and most, but it seems like public broadcasting is uniquely set up to compete and differentiate itself in other areas besides those two.
Well, I agree with you. I think that by the in this new world order that we're in now, if you want to know, did they arrest the suspect in the attempted bombing in at Times Square? There, you can find out in a second. All right, but who was this guy? Well, what do you want to know about him? Was he part of a group? What group? Well, where'd that group come from? And you just keep asking questions. Well, was the law enforcement thing right? How did this guy get loose to get on an airplane in the first place? And why was he going to Dubai? Well, where's Dubai? What is Dubai? In other words, every step along the way, there's got to be a place that you can continue to go. And public broadcasting, in my opinion, is the place that takes you through those various steps. We always got to keep in mind that the old way of doing things, which is the first thing used to be the first time you heard about a story was when you read your newspaper. By the time you read a newspaper now, you know everything. You know what happened long before you ever see that newspaper. So what's the point of the newspaper now? Is to go start peeling it back, keep moving back, moving back, moving back. One of the reasons newspapers are not doing very well because they haven't caught on to that. They haven't trained their folks to move the story with where the curiosity is about the story. And in public broadcasting, the NewsHour, we tried very hard to do that. And sometimes we fail. It doesn't work. We can no longer see ourselves as the first responder journalist. You've got to be that second and third. And you put your finger on it. This is still a development stage for that. And it's got to be compelling. I mean, you got to realize there are all kinds of places you can go second or third time, second or third step after you find, well, I already know about they arrested the guy. All right, but now who do I want to go take the next step? And you've got, I'm not interested in the New York Times. Maybe I'm, you know, we, but you've got to, it's got to all be there. And those of us who are in this business have to go with the new flow. And public broadcasting should be leading the way. Some ways we are, some ways we're not.
Jim Lehrer. He died January 23rd at the age of 85. It was an incredible honor to get to meet Mr. Lehrer. The fact that he showed up in person at my apartment in Los Angeles was sincerely one of the highlights of my career. And he was as kind and engaged and warm and brilliant off the microphone as he was on. I don't think I've ever been more thrilled than when he said to me he was really impressed with the operation I was running and he'd love to have lunch with me sometime if I ever visited Washington, D.C. I didn't get to have lunch with him, unfortunately, but I am so grateful for his incredible work and his incredible career. I'll never lose the memories not only of meeting him but also of watching the NewsHour with my dad as a kid on our 10-inch black and white television. He was an unimpeachable journalist, and I'm grateful for his contributions to our world. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is produced at MaximumFun.org world headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where Kevin, our producer, and Christian Duenas, a producer here in our office, were walking around when they saw two squirrels holding a total of 3 peanuts. They were unshelled. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We got help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellows are Jordan Cowling and Melissa Duenas. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team. Our thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. Like us there, follow us there, and I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.